Hey y'all, it's Susan Darrow, your host of Border Radio right here on KPFD. I hope you'll join me for Border Radio Monday through Friday mornings from 9:30 to noon on KPFD Houston.
That is the mesmerizing beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. That means it's time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and storytelling right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, community radio in Houston. Well, I'm your host tonight, Eric Heen, and here we celebrate the power of story. We do this by featuring guests every week who will take us on magical journeys through their imaginations. What do you think about when you hear the word gypsy? If you're like me, you probably get these visions of mysterious, nomadic people traveling in caravans, horse-driven wagons, dancing, playing tambourines, fortune tellers. But there's a lot more to the gypsy and Romani world than these stereotypes indicate. And tonight, we're going to learn more about these fascinating people by hearing from two authentic Romani storytellers from Europe. Both of them were actually born into traveling gypsy communities. And after you hear their stories and their comments, I think you might get a whole new appreciation about Romani people and their culture. Our guests are Richard O'Neill from England and Dr. Adrian Marsh, originally from England, but now living in Istanbul, Turkey. So let's get to our first guest, Richard O'Neill. Richard was born and raised in a large traditional Romani family in the north of England. He grew up in a vigorous storytelling tradition, learning his skills from some of the best traveling storytellers in England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. Richard is now the author of 11 children's books, and his stories and plays have been broadcast on BBC Radio. His latest book, Yaki and the Parno Grai, has been called the perfect reminder of the power of imagination by the Sunday Times. Richard, it's great to have you here on So What's Your Story?
It's good to be here.
Now, Richard, it sounds like you've had a fascinating upbringing. And I was just wondering, how has growing up in that nomadic type environment, how has that affected you as a storyteller?
Well, first of all, it taught me about storytelling, and I just took that in. It was organic, because story was all we had. Most of the people I grew up with couldn't read or write, so story was a way to communicate between each other. They told us our history through story. Pretty much everything came through story. So I was, if you will, sort of immersed in it from being a baby. And I'm convinced that actually helped me. When I wanted to read, I saw my first book when I was four, and I was fascinated by this book, and I wanted to read it, and I taught myself to read it. And I'm convinced that I could do that, because I had been immersed in story and I understood words and I knew how they went together. So that's where my upbringing was, in a completely nomadic Romani family. And I guess I'm probably one of the I sound like an endangered species, but I'm probably one of the last people around who was born in England into that traditional nomadic family, totally nomadic. And it was fabulous, wonderful.
So are there still some travelers, some people still living the nomadic lifestyle like that in England?
There are, but it gets harder and harder. And I think people, they will travel for a part of the year now, and then they will live on a site, on a park home, on a trailer site for the rest of the year, or in a house for the rest of the year. So I think there are very few fully nomadic as we were.
Ah, so it's a vanishing lifestyle now.
Fortunately, the culture is still strong.
Yeah.
So the actual physical lifestyle might be changing, but the culture, I think, if anything, has become stronger.
Oh, I was going to ask you, before we get to the stories, I've seen the term while researching for this show, I've seen the terms gypsy, Romani, and travelers. those three terms keep coming up. Now, is that the same thing or is there differences?
Different groups. People believe that we all came from India originally and we were Romani people. But as we traveled through Europe, people, because we were darker of skin and had a different language, they thought we were Egyptians. So they called us Egyptians for quite a long time. And then eventually that was shortened to Gypsy. And then in England, in the UK, we have Irish travelers. So we have three main groups.
Now let's get to your stories, Richard. You are a storyteller, a very accomplished one. First story, I believe, is about your uncle.
It is. I had a lot of uncles and we had a large extended family and we would travel around as a small group and then other people would come and join us for a while and they'd go off. And so there was this always this interchanging of people. And when people came, they brought new stories. And these stories are all family stories. They're all Romani family stories. But there's always one person, isn't there, in every family who wants to do something different. And my uncle was that, a quite very mild-mannered, lovely man who went out to work every day. And his job was, as what we would say in England, a rag and bone man. Now, a rag and bone man would go and collect cloth, old rags, shirts, clothes. And in the old days, they would collect bones as well. And people say, well, animal bones. And why would they do that? Well, the kids are quite happy. When you talk to kids these days, they're quite happy. I understand about recycling. Clothes can be turned into new clothes and you can use clothes, especially cotton, in the very best paper. But why bones? And when you tell them that there wasn't those little glue stick things in those days, it was animal glue and the bones would be boiled up. Every town had a glue factory and you could get money for the bones. But my uncle had expanded a little bit by then into the 1960s, and he still had a horse and cart because eco-friendly, no engines to go wrong, everything great for him. And him and my auntie would set off on a morning, and she would sit at the front of this cart, because they had a seat at the front of the cart, four-wheel cart. And if they were going somewhere slightly different, then he would drop her off, and she would go and do some shopping, look around the town or whatever, go and buy some food. And he would go and try and find something. So he'd put leaflets out through people's doors and he'd try and find some rag and bone. And in those days, they might be old brass candlesticks that people no longer wanted, a piece of furniture that was broken he could fix up and sell. So anyway, he knocks on this door and this lady's put the leaflet out. And she says, I've got something for you. And he goes in the house to have a look at it. Now, I need to tell you about my uncle, and he was obsessed with sci-fi. Now, whenever there was a film on at the cinema, in the 1950s film, and the Americans were great at doing this, the invasions of the body snatchers and all these Martians that would come down and, would want to take people to Mars or whatever. And my uncle was obsessed with this. He was the only one in the family and he got ridiculed for it. And he was obsessed. And every time he'd go and see the space film and he'd say, people are going to land on the moon. People are going to eat. Don't be silly. Anyway, he got quite ridiculed for it. And he'd sit around the fire at night and people would be talking about horses and they'd be talking about this and talking about that. And my uncle would want to talk about, his latest film or his sci-fi comic. And he'd get laughed at really. He'd say, oh, grow up, the kids stuff now. Come on. Anyway, so he'd had about enough of this. And an opportunity came. So he knocks on the door and this lady says, she said, I've got something. She said, but I'm not giving it away for free. She says, you're going to have to buy it. He says, well, what is it? So she goes inside and her husband had worked on the docks in Liverpool and he had one of these. He passed away, this old man, and she'd been left this diving suit. Now, the proper old fashioned diving suit with the big metal helmet with the grid at the front.
Wow.
A beautiful thing. So he's thinking either I can sort of, I can sell this to somebody down in London or something, or somebody will buy this. This is like an antique, even in those days. So anyway, he says, how much do you want for it, And she says, well, it's going to be this amount. And anyway, they come to an agreement. And when he picks his wife back up, my auntie, and she says, have you had a good day? He says, well, I've got all this, I've got this. He said, but I've spent a few bob. He said, I must have spent a few pounds. He said, I've bought this. She said, what is it? He said, well, it's a diving suit. He said, the people go mad for these down in London, I can guarantee you. She says, how much have you spent on that? He said, look, but it's not just that. He said, I've got a plan for it as well. So they have their tea, and the women have gone off to put the children to bed, which is a traditional thing, and then they go and have their own evening talking with each other. And the men have gone to sit round the fire, different fire, and they're all talking, and they see my uncle, oh, we've been up to today, and they're buying him all them comics, are you going to take off in a rocket, are you? And he just thinks, nah. She said, come here, are you not coming to sit round the fire? He says, nah, I'm tired. He says, it's been a busy day. I'm going to go back in my caravan, my trailer, and I'm going to go and have an early night anyway. So they're all sat around the fire, these men, and they're talking about this and talking about that. And all of a sudden they hear a noise, and one of them looks round, and he absolutely freaks out. And he looks at the others and he says, look, 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 look. And there's my uncle dressed up in the diving suit, putting on this perfect voice that you would have heard from the cinema, you know, calling out to these earthlings. They ran off to their caravans. You've never seen anything like it. And the next day, of course, when he unveiled what it was, nobody really ever tried to ridicule him again. But yeah, that was, I see that picture in my mind so many times of my uncle coming upon these men, because people did think in those days that, you know, the Martians might come down, sure, and take you away. And yeah, so that was one of my favorite stories from my uncle. And well, I can see him now.
Yes. I wonder whatever happened to that diving suit. Did he ever sell it?
Well,
you know,
that's really interesting. I wonder what he did. Being my uncle, you know, he would have sold it. He would have, when they were traveling further down the country, maybe towards London, he would have sold it. He would have found a buyer for it. But you know, that's the other thing for us about story, is that we believe that our ancestors, our family are never really gone, because we keep them alive in story.
Yes. That's what our show is about here, is stories. And that's a topic that comes up quite a bit, how stories create this continuity through the generations. I mean, if you hadn't had those stories retold through the generations, we wouldn't be hearing about this.
Exactly. And another interesting thing, I think, for me about the Romani people was that they didn't think their stories had a value outside of the family. And it was only when I started telling stories probably professionally about 15 years ago, and then writing the children's books, that people started to think, oh, wow, yeah. And I think about my dad, and who's long gone, and a lot of my older relatives who I grew up with, who were quite Victorian in many ways. Just what they would think of their stories traveling the world.
Well, I can tell you, Richard, your stories have a big appeal for the outside world because, okay, growing up for me, my perception of gypsies or Romani people was all these stereotypes, what I saw from movies, you know, the singers and dancers and fortune tellers. So one good thing about hearing the stories is we get a more accurate picture of the Romani people. They're not these caricatures we've seen in the movies. You got another story here? It's also about your upbringing, I believe.
I do. And I was the only gypsy kid. And I use the words interchangeable. I quite like the word gypsy. So I was the only gypsy kid in a secondary school. Now, most of my relatives did not transfer from primary or elementary to high school. And because we were settled at the time, I had to go to high school. Uh-huh. If I hadn't gone to high school, my parents would have got into trouble. So I have to go to high school. I don't really like it. So anyway, I go to school and I'm the only gypsy kid in the school. Now, this is the early 1970s. This is pop music. This is glam rock. Mm-hmm. This is everything's great. Everything's moving. It's fantastic. Now, in the States, you had, and I loved his voice. I thought it was a great, great singer. You had this wonderful artist that would come over to England. David Cassidy was a, yeah, you see, you're chuckling, and he's a heartthrob, you know? And I can remember watching on TV as David Cassidy flew in. It was made our main news in England, and girls were fainting, and people were just like, David, David. Anyway, now, we had, I don't know, you may not have heard of him in the States, but we had our equivalent of David Cassidy was another David called David Essex. And, well, David Essex, a huge, huge pop star, heartthrob, real good-looking man. Now, I had an older sister who was a teenager. I would be sort of like 11, and she'd be sort of like 16, 17. So she would get these magazines that would have pop stars in them. Now, I'm a big reader. Ever since I could read, I read everything, and I still do it now. I read signs and back of sauce bottles, you name it, I'll read it. Anyway, my sister had this magazine, and I like pop music. And I would read through her magazines, and after a while, I'd watch read a little bit. Now, I'm at school, and nothing is going right for me. Now, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who would identify with this. You're a certain age. You're 11, you're 12, you feel awkward. There are cliques, there are groups of people that you're not in with that group. I'm the only gypsy kid in the school. It's a rough and tough school. I'm not a physical person by nature, but I have to fight with some of these boys because they pick fights with me. And then it just goes on. And then my mum and dad, they're going to get in trouble. So like most kids, I don't say to my mum and dad, you know, it's horrible at school. I hate it. I'm watching the clock go down. Every day, it's awful, but I just carry on. So every time I come home from school, I just, oh God, Sunday night is the worst night of the week because I'm thinking I've got to go to school on Monday and horrible. So this is all going on, and I'm really unpopular. Now, the worst thing is the other, and you will know this rock star, and they all seem to be called David, don't they? These people, David Bowie, right? Huge, huge English pop star at the same time. So we've got David Bowie, we've got David Essex, we've got David Cassidy. Now, David Bowie had a hairstyle, and you could even go to the barber shop and get this Bowie or Bowie cut, which was sort of like a dandelion clock almost on the top of your head, and it cut a bit short at the back. Now, my hair would not do that. My hair is curly. My hair sticks out more at one side than the other, you know, so I would be there at home, teenager, listening to pop music on this little radio and thinking, I want to get my hair like David Bowie. That'll make me popular at school. I put water on it. There's no such thing as gel in those days. I put water on it. Oh, look at that. It looks great until it, of course, it dried out and ping, 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 all these little curls come out. That's just not working for me. I'm never going to be popular. So I come home one afternoon. My sister's magazine's delivered. It's a Thursday. She's looked at it. She's gone out the way. I just think, I open it up, and there is David Essex, right, who I did like. I liked his music. And I start reading it. And it says, David Essex is from a gypsy family. Ooh. And I'm like, what? It's like I've discovered, you know, treasure. I'm like, really? This can't be true. And he's quite out about it, you know. And he looks like me. He's got hair like me. And he's like us. And I say to my dad, I go rushing off. I go, Dad, David Essex is a gypsy. He goes, who's David Essex? I said, well, he's a pop star. He said, where's he from? Because my dad knew everybody in the travelling community. So I said, well, I don't know, Dad. Maybe from London or somewhere. He goes, what's he called? I said, Essex. He said, we don't know any Essexes. So I said, right, okay, I'm not. Next day when I go to school, David Essex is a huge star. I mention it to a few people, and it spreads like wildfire. Now I'm popular. I am, for the first time in my life, I'm popular because somehow people have thought that I am some way connected to David Essex. He's the only gypsy pop star they know. I'm the only gypsy they know. So then I get this girl who I really like, right, called Lynn. And I'm only about 12, but, you know, you get these little crushes, don't you, when you're younger. And older people say, oh, dismiss it, you know, but I really like Lynn. And she was everything that, you know, you would want at that age. And so there's no chance of me. But anyway, Lynn and her friend come up and say, is it true that you're from David Essex and same family and all that? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I lie. And then the next few days, everything's fine. And then she comes up and she says, can you get me his autograph? And I say, yeah, no problem. So fortunately, they used to have these posters in the magazine. It was the middle page and you could take them out. And it did have the autograph on there. So I traced that. I'm not proud of this, by the way, but it was difficult circumstances. I was doing my best. I was 12. So I take this in the next day. Lynn is like, oh, Lynn is just like, you know, she's just in love with me now and I'm in love with her and everything's great. And then other people find out and they say, can you get me his autograph? And I say, yeah, no problem. So I'm at night now, you know, I'm doing all these autographs. I must have done 40 or 50 autographs. And then as it does, it goes round school. We're having an extension built onto this school because it's growing. The school is growing. And the deputy head teacher comes up to me and he says, he takes me out of a lesson. He says, O'Neill, I think, what have I done now? He goes, a moment. So I come out. He goes, I believe you're related to this David Essex chap then, this rock pop person. I can't stop lying now. So I said, yeah. I think he's going to probably give me some time off or something. But he says, right. He says, it's because we're looking for somebody to open the new sports hall. Do you think he'll do it? I said, well, I can ask him. He says, look, he said, I'll create a letter for you to give to your parents. He said, take it home and ask your parents to pass it on to Mr. Essex. So I get this letter and I get home and I'm thinking, oh my God, now what have I done? What am I going to do? I can't show it to my mum and dad because then I'm going to be done for them for being deceitful. And I can't say no to this teacher. So now there's this huge, now at school is even worse. It's a massive flaming vortex. But Lynn likes me. And I like Lynn, so I'm not really that bothered. I want to go to school, but in the back of my mind's this huge weight weighing me down. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to tell my mum and dad. And then just going backwards and forwards, and I'm thinking, I'm going to tell my mum and dad. And it's all underway because I keep seeing this deputy head teacher now, and he keeps sort of smiling. Morning. She's never noticed me before, and you know, since I've been at the school for 2 years. But now it's, good morning, O'Neill, good morning. And I'm thinking, oh, anyway, my mum says to me, I get home this particular afternoon, and my mum sits me down living in a little house, and she said, I've got something I need to talk to you about. I think, oh my God, she's found out I'm busted. This is it. This is good. The reputation, because my mum and dad, you know, are very, very keen on keeping our reputation as good people, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm just going to be this worst, horrible liar. And anyway, she says, look, she says, it's not worked out in this house. She said, and I'm sorry, she said, about this, but, and I know it's going to spoil your education a little bit, and it's the last thing I wanted, son, it really is. She said, but we're going to have to leave. She said, so we're going back in trailers. I said, when? She said, don't get upset now. She said, it's going to be Monday or Tuesday next week. So I could have kissed her. I'm like, yes, but I didn't do that. I go, oh, ma'am, that's terrible, but, you know, everything for the family, in it, you know, that's what we do. She says, oh, I'm so pleased that you're so understanding. She says, that's good. Your sisters took it very bad, she said, but you seem to be, you always think about the family, don't you? And I think, yeah. Anyway, I go to school for a couple more days, and it comes the Friday, and he's still the deputy head teacher. We're only about 2 weeks off now, I think, and he's keep giving me the eye. All right, O'Neill, all right. Oh, yeah. Anyway, we get in the van, and we've got the caravan on the back, and we're heading down the road. And I'm just like, we go past the school, and I'm just like, yes, thank you. And off we go into the sunset, never to go back to that school again. And people say to me, why do you keep mentioning David Essex? And I said, well, because he pretty much saved my life. Because if that hadn't have happened, I wouldn't have got Lynn, you know, who was my first girlfriend. And I certainly probably would have been in detention in that school for the next 3 or 4 years. Wow. So thank goodness for David Essex. That's what I say. I've never met him, but whenever I do, I'm going to shake his hand and say, thank you. You saved my life in high school.
Is he still alive?
He's still alive, yeah. Yeah, and he has been a very good advocate for gypsy people, actually. So he's because unfortunately in England still that we do have quite a few Romani people who are in the entertainment world and in other fields, but don't want to come out about their ethnicity because it will be it will probably cause them quite a few problems, which is a shame. Right. But, you know, it's everybody's choice. I'm very open about mine. You know, it's everybody's choice. Sure. I wouldn't want to have been born in any other family. Right. I wouldn't want to have been brought up any other way. You know, I'm proud of where I come from, and I'm proud of what we do.
Well, David Essex has got to hear that story someday. He's got to hear that. We'll send him the tape here or something.
Oh, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? You know, but again, you know, I think, you know, people talk about role models, and he wasn't really a role model to me, but it was just having that recognition. Sure. That, you know, as a boy on my own, having to tough it out, but there was just this the little shaft of light there.
Yeah.
And that's really, really important, I think, for any child who's in that situation to think there is something. And I think that's what story does.
Yes.
It allows us to connect,
mm-hmm.
you know. And yes, mine was a web of deceit. I admit that. But in my defense, I was 12, not even 12 quite, and under a lot of pressure. So
did that kind of instill a change in you about being a Romani person? Were you a bit more maybe open about it?
Absolutely, because that was the first time in my life growing up, you know, going to school from 5 years old. So in that 7 years, that was the first time in any education that I'd actually had people thinking it was a good thing to be a gypsy person. So it was a positive, and that was the first time, you know, and that's why it's so important to me to get these books into school, mm-hmm. to get stories into school, because some of the negative things that you would see, and that's not saying that, you know, everybody in the traveling community is an angel, far from it. No community is perfect, but there is good and bad, like there is in every community.
Yeah. Now, speaking of famous people who have a Romani origin, while I was researching for this show, I discovered that apparently Charlie Chaplin, he has Romani origins. Have you heard about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Charlie Chaplin, his son was searching through a piece of furniture in probably about 8-9 years ago, maybe a little bit more, mm-hmm. came across this letter which alluded to the fact that Charlie was born in a wagon on this piece of ground in Birmingham called Black Patch, where Romani people lived for 50 years. They lived until the Industrial Revolution took it away. I think because of his colouring, people believed, or they just thought he was Jewish. But his mother was called Mary Smith, and she was a Romani person. And I think his father was a circus performer. But yeah, really, really interesting. There'll be certain people listening to your show who are probably similar age to me, or a little bit older even, who will know of an actor called Yul Brynner.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, now, Yul Brynner was one of the major players in organizing the first Romani World Congress in 1971.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Really, really fascinating character, of course, you know, great actor.
Sure.
But really fascinating. And in 1971, in the world's first Romani Congress, then they actually got Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India at the time, to allow the Romani people to take the chakra, the wheel, off the Indian flag and put it onto the Romani flag.
Uh-huh.
So the Romani flag has that link to the Indian flag, which is, to me, is fascinating.
Yeah, I've noticed that. There's an official international Romani flag, and the symbol, the biggest feature on it is a wagon wheel, obviously to depict the traveling nomadic lifestyle.
Yeah, and the link to India, and it's a, you know, it's a nice straightforward flag, blue for the sky, green for the grass, and the chakra or the wheel for movement. Yeah. And it's a lovely flag. I do love that flag. But I don't care whether it's a Romani child or any child in school. I don't want any child to feel excluded
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason. Every child deserves to have a champion, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what I try and do. I want to be a champion for as many children as possible and encourage other people to do that, because I know it's a cliche, but they are our future. And we don't know which one of those children is going to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
For the better. We just don't know. You know, I could talk about stories all day till your radio station closes down for the night. You know, they're everything to me. You know, that's how I was brought up. They're our history. They're our communication. They're how you make your living. So they're pretty much everything to us.
Right. Well, I really appreciate the contributions you're making to the storytelling world here. Now, Richard, before we let you go, I want to ask you about your most recent book. It's got some great reviews. I see the Sunday Times said it's been a perfect reminder of the power of imagination. And the book is called Yaki and the Parno Gry. Can you tell us a bit about that book?
I can. First of all, Yaki is the boy's name, and he's the lead character, and he's based a little bit on me. And the Parno Gry is the white horse. The reason why the white horse, I think, is so important is because in the old days, to try and find a white horse, it was extremely rare. You know, horses were colored. They weren't this white. And to try and find one, it was quite a unique thing. And in the story of Yaki and the Parno Gry, it's a story from my family. And it's based on some very hard times. Things were changing. They had lots of agricultural work. And then agriculture was mechanized. 1920s, 1930s. And these people's lives, my family's lives, became smaller and smaller and smaller. There wasn't the same places to stop. And things were getting really bad. But then there's this boy, and he tells the children stories. And the granddad says, well, you know, what's the point of just telling these children stories? You know, tomorrow's not going to be a very good day. And the grandma says, well, wouldn't you like them to go to sleep tonight? Uh-huh. Full of joy. Mm-hmm. And then we'll face tomorrow when it comes. And without spoiling the book, you know, it does have a happy ending. And what I always try and say to adults is, this family have this white horse which comes to save them, called the Parno Gry. Mm. And I believe we all need one of those. And I talked about it earlier when I said about David Essex. He was my Parno Gry when I was 12. But, you know, what's your Parno Gry? What is your thing that gets you through life? What is your thing that allows you to think beyond where you are now? Because sometimes we can't change what's happening now, but we can change how we think about the future.
Okay, so that's the theme of the book. Yeah, I ordered it on Amazon. Can't wait to get it and read it to my grandkids. They love stories like that. Well, Richard, I really appreciate you being here with us this evening. Could you leave us with some parting thoughts, any final words of wisdom about the Romani people?
Well, before I do, let me just say it's been an absolute pleasure. The time, I've just looked at the time now, and it's flown by, which is what we want, you know, when we're enjoying ourselves. The only thought I would leave people with is, look, stories are the most valuable things in the world. Mm. Keep them close to your heart. Carry them around with you and share them with people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
That's great. Okay, well, I can't think of better words to conclude this segment with. And thanks again, Richard, and good luck to you in all your endeavors.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye. Well, we're going to take a break from our storytellers here tonight for station identification and to make a few announcements. You're listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM, community radio in Houston. And here's what's going on in the world of storytelling in the Houston area. First of all, our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild at houstonstorytellers.org. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. And until the pandemic is over, they're meeting on Zoom conferences. So go to their website at houstonstorytellers.org for more information. While you're on that same site, click on the tab Radio Program, and a page will appear with all of the archive programs from our show, dating all the way back to 2008. And remember, you can live stream us every Thursday at 8 p.m. on kpft.org. Our Facebook page is called So What's Your Story, and we're also on YouTube. And one nice thing about us, we're 100% non-commercial. So you won't see a bunch of ads and cookies. And also, we're a very interactive program. So if you have any suggestions or comments, requests for guests, drop us an email at story@kpft.org. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Organization, who have monthly story slams. Usually they're at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of every month. So check them out at themoth.org. And now here are some interesting facts about the Romani people. I got these from childhub.org and listserv.com. The Romani are a worldwide diaspora who have never had their own country, although they do have a common flag and share a common language. This language, Romanus, is strictly a spoken language with no known alphabet. About 6 million Romani still speak this language. The Romani have no religion of their own. They're believed to have been originally Hindu, but these days they ordinarily adopt the religions of their host countries. Elements of Romani music feature prominently in modern jazz, bolero, and flamenco music, including classical composers like Franz Liszt. The word gypsy comes from the mistaken belief that the Roma people who migrated to Europe came from Egypt. Romani weddings have been known to last for up to 2 weeks. Famous people of Romani origin include Pablo Picasso, Charlie Chaplin, Rita Hayworth, Michael Caine, and boxer Tyson Fury. Although many people believe the nomadic life of the gypsies was by choice, it was usually because they were banished from all the areas they tried to settle, thus giving them no alternative but to live their lives constantly on the move. Now let's get back to our storytellers. Tonight we're hearing from two excellent Romani storytellers. And our next guest tonight is the very accomplished Romani researcher and expert consultant, Dr. Adrian Marsh. Dr. Marsh is of UK Romani traveler origins, and he works with Romani, Gypsy, and traveler communities in the UK, Sweden, Turkey, Egypt, and across Central and Eastern Europe. Dr. Marsh has taught Romani studies at universities in London, Stockholm, Cairo, Istanbul, and Lyon. He is currently living in Istanbul, where he leads the International Romani Studies Network, an NGO he established there in 2002. Dr. Marsh, it's an honor to have you here on So What's Your Story?
Thank you very much, or parikarav, as we say in Anglo-Romani.
So, Dr. Marsh, here on our program, we're all about stories and storytelling. In your experience, how important are stories to the Romani culture?
I would say that they're critical, really, in the sense that the culture itself, and we're talking about culture in the sense of a group culture. So there are lots of there's lots of diversity. There's a great deal of variation in terms of how Romani communities approach the idea of storytelling. But for the most part, storytelling is at the heart of it. And in that sense, if you're looking for an understanding about Romani and traveler people, then you need to look at stories. And when I say stories, I don't just mean what is told in stories, but I also mean in terms of the art, for example. So in that sense, stories are crucially there in Romani and traveler cultures.
Now, before we get to your story, we got to emphasize, you were born and raised into a traveling nomadic community. Is that correct?
I was born and raised into what is a mixed community. There are some examples that were back then, it was less common, but there was a marriage between the Romani and the traveler community. And when I say traveler, I mean the Mincieri, the Irish travelers. There is still a difference, and there's still some degree of separation between these communities, even in South Wales today. But there are some marriages that cross the boundaries, and I was born into one of those mixed families, with my father being from the Irish traveller side, which comes into the story, and my mum being from the Romani side, the English Romani side.
Oh, one other thing I'd like to establish at the outset here, the term gypsy, is that considered as derogatory?
It is a complex and difficult subject. So when it comes to Welsh and English communities and Scottish communities, then the term gypsy with a capital G always with a capital G, is perfectly acceptable, and it is an ethnonym. It is a self-ascribed ethnic label. Okay. And it's one that's recognized under United Kingdom law. If you're talking about other communities elsewhere, then it is not. For example, if you're talking about the French, it's less and less the case that you can use the word Tsigan anymore. Or if you're talking about communities in Spain, there aren't many communities still happy with the term Gitano, all of which are translations of the word gypsy. And most communities, especially in Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe, would like people to use or insist on people using the term Roma. However, that being said, English and Welsh gypsies would prefer to be called gypsies.
Well, now let's get to your story here. Would you like to preface it at all?
I will start with it, and then I think we can talk about it, particularly about some of the words I will use. We can talk about it in between. So let's have the first part of it. I was born in a traveling family in Cardiff, Wales. My mother was from the Rag and Bone people, that in Folky. Her daddo was a Totin man, collecting what the gorgers left behind or threw away. There was money in it, Pa said, though he couldn't hear us as he'd been bombed in the war and was as deaf as a post. My daddo was the arty one, puppets and silk flowers, a window dresser by trade. He was from the Irish, travellers from County Longford in the Irish Midlands by the Bog of Cats. We moved up and down the Newport Road, sometimes staying long enough in one place for one of my sisters to be born. There were two by the time we left Cardiff. I learned a bit of Cymraeg by then, the Welsh, though I can't speak it now, and Pogody Chib, rocker in the Romneys, though not in front of the gorgers. I learned the hiding ways young, careful, secret, one eye over your shoulder like. When we left for the Achintan, back to the family yard on southern England's coast, we were camping up and down along the way, in army towns and amongst country people too. We got to Portsmouth when I was still a little chabby, where we had folky, joeys and slanging buffers in the seaside circus and arcades. Behind us, a trail of words tossed like trash in the drum by the gorgers, gippo, tinker, and worse.
Now, these rag and bone people, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. Tatin folky is a Romney term for rag and bone people, the people who are the original recyclers, if you like. And my grandpa, or pa, as we used to call him, my mum's dad, he was a rag and bone man. And that's how he started, collecting what people threw away and recycling it, either recycling it in the sense of selling it on if it was scrap metal or the like, or if it was a sense of cleaning things up and then reselling them to poorer families, or if it was the case of actually bringing stuff home, which his family could use. I kind of grew up with, what can we say, secondhand toys. So that's what we mean by Totin Folky and rag and bone people. So rag and bone people with their little donkey carts or their little horse carts, they're disappearing, and yet, arguably, we still need them much more than ever before, perhaps.
Sure. Okay, and can we get back to your story now?
Certainly. School was cushy in the infant's class, growing Cress and Janet and John books, learned to read and spell to take apples away from pears, and nobody seemed to mind, or nobody knew. I stopped worrying, got on with playing with sand and finger painting, the knots in my stomach disappearing. Because school was big, no family here. The kids were kids, not chavvies, but they didn't ken I was. Dropped the accent, though, soon as. Singing like a taff from the valleys was going to get me mullered. Learned the Cockney as Pompey people were from the smoke in the olden times.
Ah. So, Dr. Marsh, it's no secret that the Romani and traveler people, they've often suffered some pretty bad oppression and discrimination throughout the history. Have you experienced any of this firsthand in your upbringing?
This is what this story is about. The section where I talk about having knots in my stomach going to school is precisely that feeling of being frightened of those around me and worried that they will find out who and what I am. and facing the consequences, as happens in the story. And that fear of being out in the world and being concerned that you are going to be targeted, whether it's just through language, in the first section, I talk about words like jipo, tinker, etc. These are words that are used as pejoratives. They're used as insults. Mm-hmm. Or actual physical violence, which, we'll wait for the end of the story. But yes, that kind of thing is very much a part and parcel of growing up as a Romani or a traveller. So it's something that is the last seemingly acceptable form of racism and discrimination. Being bad to gypsies and travellers, calling them pikies and tinkers and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I understand there are a fair amount of Romani people who have had to try to hide their identity.
Indeed, that's a very important thing to remember. And what, in a sense, that if we take it beyond the personal to the wider world, hiding identity is what saved numbers of people, Roma and Sinti people in Central Europe between 1939 and 1945, when 1.5 million Roma and Sinti were exterminated by the Nazis and associated regimes across occupied Europe. So hiding is a way of not just avoiding confrontation, it's also a way of physically surviving.
You mentioned school. Now, yes. You were in a nomadic community, but there were times that you would settle in places and actually be going to public schools?
Yes. The art of going to school as a Romani child was to avoid other kids finding out. So that meant birthday parties. You never invited people home for your birthday. You avoided any people coming home at any cost. It was kind of being a bit separated out, but not in a way that made you the target if you could help it.
Well, that would make for a very stressful childhood. Let's get back to your story then. So
this is the final section. Then juniors, things got jumpy. Got seen parking for sixpences from the tourists in the summer by Raymond's mum. And I knew she'd clocked me. Seen who I was and what I was. Come September, that was going to come back, bite me in the ass. Started in the playground. Pikey, pikey, do as you likey. Then the long walk home, past the bingo hall, and the steps seemed full of sharp, spiky bodies and twisted faces. Angry, raging, really. When the first one hit me, I thought, this is it. This is what it's going to be like for the rest of the year. Didn't go back to school much after that.
Well, I can see why the Romani people try to hide their identity. I would very much do that too, I'm sure.
And some of the things that I talk about here, juniors meaning junior school. So we're talking about that period in school between the ages of 7 to 11, 12. And I also describe the economic reality here because parking was an occupation. It's what the kids did. We had little bikes, usually which we'd put together ourselves. And we would, during the summer, I grew up in a seaside town, Portsmouth, on the south coast of England. And tourists were always coming by car, and there was always a problem finding parking spaces. So we would race around. When I say we, I mean me and cousins. We would race around on our little bikes, finding the spaces, and then finding people who were driving up and down looking for a space, tapping on the window and say, all right, mister, give us sixpence, I'll show you where to park. And that's how we earn some money during the summer.
Sounds like you'd have to get creative in ways of finding income.
Indeed. My main source of income was actually cleaning shoes, which goes back to a later episode when I got into grammar school. But that's a story for another time. But yes, so there are always ways in which you try to add to the family income because it was always necessary.
So, Dr. Marsh, in general, would you say that attitudes towards the Romani people, are they improving or getting worse or staying the same? Where are we in that regard?
I would like to say that things are improving with greater tolerance and a better understanding about diversity in the world today amongst different populations. But sadly, this is something that is dependent upon geography. And without trying to blanket condemn a whole region and millions of people, I would say that in Central, Southeast, and Eastern Europe, attitudes are not getting better. They are not particularly improving. And in some particular parts, some particular countries, Slovakia, for example, being one, or the Czech Republic being another, they are actually deteriorating. And again, it's about the growth of populist politics. It's about economic problems coming into play. Hungary, for example, is somewhere where there's a definite political agenda based on anti-Roma-ism, if you can call it that, anti-Gypsyism. I would also say, if you'll forgive me, I would also say that's becoming more and more true in the United States too, particularly under the previous administration. We saw the rise of anti-Gypsyism as a part of what was a bigger agenda around anti-immigration and obsession with difference and the others. So it's hard to see improvement, and it's difficult to see how that might change in the near future. And I guess the only way is to see a more tolerant and inclusive society being built. So we shall look for what happens in the US, as so often it leads the rest of the world.
We got, like you say, there's some traveler presence in America, but we hardly ever hear about it. It seems like it's Europe is the big area. I've never met any travelers here.
Oh, there's a big community in Texas, a big community of Romney Chows, which is Romney Chows is the Romney word for English gypsies. Romney Chows, or descended from Romney Chows. There's also a fair number of Caldarash Romney people who are originally Romanian from the 1860s. Romney slavery was... Romney's people have been slaves from 1350 until 1860 in Romania and Hungary and elsewhere.
That's not long ago, 1860.
No, it's not.
What can I say in America about...
Well, I was saying the combination is, or the coincidence, perhaps it's not, I don't know, but slavery was forcibly eradicated in both the United States, of course, as you know, but also in Romania around the same time, same years.
Same time.
So you have a big community of Romney people, both Romney Chows and Caldarash in Texas.
Okay, Dr. Marsh, you have been a wealth of information here. I've really broadened my horizons about the Romani people, and I'm sure for our listeners as well. So do you have any parting thoughts for us? Any final words of wisdom on your experiences, the Romani people, whatever you'd like to convey to our audience?
I think one of the key things is a lesson I learned a long time ago, which is always to call people what they call themselves. And not just Romney and traveler people, but all people. The label that people use about themselves is the correct term. So never impose upon others, whether it's a term that you might think is possibly pejorative or whether it's a term that is just incorrect. Always find out what people call themselves by asking. So what do you call yourself? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of basis for respect, I think. And I think the other thing to remember is that we have a language, we have a culture, we have many different traditions. We have a history that goes back to the 8th century in India. So we were a people, if you like, who came together in what was the 11th century in Byzantium, which is actually arguably, before the English people come into existence at that point. They're still... You know, the English aren't the English until 12th, 13th century, and the Swedish certainly aren't the Swedish until 12th, 13th century. So before many European identities come into being, we are there as the Egyptians. That's where we are. So we are equally historical, equally as valuable as any other community in the world with a long history and a series of traditions. We're not just a marginalized group of cast-offs or outcasts.
Well, that's a very good sentiment to end this segment with. Thanks again, Dr. Marsh, and good luck to you.
Kushti bak.
Well, that is our show for tonight, folks, and I'd like to thank our guests, Richard O'Neill and Dr. Adrian Marsh, for sharing their stories about the Romani world. I've certainly learned a lot from them, and I hope you have too. Make 90.1 a part of your everyday life, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
They came brave and boldly old. One sang high and the other sang low. The other sang a rag-a-tag-a gypsy-o. It was upstairs, downstairs the lady went, but on her suit of leather old. And there came a cry from around the door. She's away with the rag-a-tag-a gypsy-o. She's away with the rag-a-tag-a gypsy-o. Then saddle for me my milk-white steed. A big horse is my speedy-o. And I will ride till I seek me bride. She's away with the...
Good news, good planet, good news.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. Bici Bus. In cities worldwide, it's common for kids to be transported by buses or cars to get to school. But that's not necessarily good for the cities or the kids. There is a healthier way to get kids to school that's also healthier for the planet. This movement began in Spain, and it's called the Bici Bus. It's not an actual bus. It's an urban caravan of students, parents, and teachers riding bikes, skateboards, rollerblades, anything human-powered with wheels. On specified days, participants can use the designated streets as bike paths for an hour before school and after, so they don't have to compete with cars. Schedules and routes are organized so students get safely to school and back, gaining extra exercise without creating carbon emissions. And it's not just the kids. Parents, teachers, and cyclists heading to work all join in for the ride. The movement has also reached as far as the western shores of the United States, as Critical Mass, a San Francisco group inspired by the Bici Bus model, started their own monthly biking caravans to school. Where there's a will, there's a way, and more bicycle-friendly city streets will be the reality as urban populations demand investment in safe cycling infrastructure for all. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
Well, they're building a gallows outside my cell, and I've got 25 minutes to go.
You've got 1 minute and 30 seconds to go.
The town's waiting just to hear me yell.
You're on the sound beat.
I got 24 minutes to go. Well, they gave me some beans for my last meal. With 23 minutes to go.
This live version of 25 Minutes to Go is from Johnny Cash's 1968 Columbia LP at Folsom Prison. 2,000 Folsom prisoners attended Cash's famed performance at the prison a year earlier. However, death row residents were not allowed. On performing a song about an execution at a prison, Cash said, "I was trying to get things close to the bone."
Then the sheriff said, "Boy, I'm gonna watch you die."
Who wrote the song that Cash used to accomplish this? None other than beloved children's author Shel Silverstein, who also wrote the Cash classic, A Boy Named Sue.
I can see the buzzards, I can hear the crows.
This episode was co-written by Syracuse University student Josh Dager as part of the Soundbeat class partnership. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Libraries. I'm Brett Barry.
90.1 FM, listener-sponsored and commercial-free, where you'll hear less talk and more music. KPFT, your Houston community station.
The music on KPFT sustains your spirit, helps you through difficult times, and brings a sense of joy and humanity to what would otherwise be an ordinary day. And your financial donation today will help sustain KPFT and ensure that we can all enjoy days filled with beautiful music. Please call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. you can make a one-time gift. Or better yet, why not consider setting up a sustaining membership? Choose an amount to donate each month until you tell us to stop. Become a sustaining member today at kpft.org.
Hi there.